Welcome to Artist on Air, today with Matt Colborne, the CEO of Quist. Artist Summit 2025 is in the books. I'm recording this podcast on Monday, just after Artist Summit. And we really appreciate all the lovely comments and all the feedback you're sending our way. And we're really excited that so many of you took up our offer to get their tickets for next year's summit on 8th of October 2026 already. If you haven't done so, now's the time to apply, and now's the time to get our best price ever. The super early bird tickets are now on sale, so head to our website and register right now. That's extremely helpful for us to understand how many tech founders are there versus how many commercial founders there are, how many early stage versus later stage founders there are, so that we can curate the best program again, invite the most relevant speakers, and work with the most relevant partners for you. Because we're building this for you. And we're really excited to build the program for next year's summit. So go to our website now to get your tickets for 2026. And now on to today's episode. I'm feeling nerdy today. We're talking about open banking and the PSD, Payment Services Directive. We're talking about Quist, a company that turns financial data into real insights and strategic advantage for businesses and individuals. So in this episode, Matt Colborne, the CEO of Quist, explains how the new era of open banking is transforming how financial data is actually accessed, shared, and used. We discuss how Quist helps banks and businesses unlock this data to automate credit checks, make it easier to open accounts, and build smarter, more customer-centric products. But we also dive into SEO tactics that Matt learned in his former role as the CEO of Search Metrics and how he builds ROI cases for potential customers. This episode is a must listen for anyone in building in fintech, building banking software, or any data-driven SaaS application. So please enjoy the episode with Matt Colborne and myself, Janis Bandorski.
Artist on Air, the podcast for B2B software and AI founders in the German-speaking region. Compiled by Janis Bandorski, Julius Göllner and Matthias Ernst.
Hey there, Matt. Welcome to Artist on Air.
Thank you very much indeed. Happy to be here.
It's so good that you came on, Matt. And we are talking about financial data today. And especially, I want to understand your journey as an entrepreneur, but also what you're building at Quist. So first question, am I pronouncing the name of your company correctly? Is it Quist?
Quist. I guess it depends on whether one is of English or German descent, but either is fine.
All right. So Quist is with a Q in the beginning. So Quist, and I think what Quist does, I always try to put this in my own words, it's a software that helps CEOs and financial managers to interpret financial data in a way that goes beyond a classical CFO role, but that they can really act on it, build better businesses, and act strategically on it. Is that a correct? You totally smash me if I'm wrong on that.
No, it's not totally wrong, but it's that's one relatively small area of what we do.
What am I missing, Matt?
Well, at a fundamental level, what we do is provide financial data in accordance with the wishes of the person that owns that data. So there's a piece of legislation very badly named called the PSD, Payment Services Directive. And the reason it's, I would argue, very badly named is because for me, the key bit in there essentially changes the nature of who owns data. So let's say you have a bank account. I'm assuming you do.
I do.
Historically, probably the bank would have said, well, the data in that bank account sits on our systems. We own it, right? We can do things with it. And that's part of the deal you have with us. What this directive did, and it's called the Open Banking or Open Finance Directive as well as a sort of unofficial name, what it did was essentially change the dynamic and say, hang on a second. This is Janis's data. This is your data. So now you have the right through a standardized interface, an API, if you like, I'm going to use the technical term, to deliver that data anywhere you want to do something useful. Okay, so the useful thing could well be and is some of the things you were just talking about, but is also useful to an individual who's saying, well, hang on a minute, I want to look at my investment strategy. Should I be saving more? Should I be actually, you know, paying off loans? Where's the best offer for insurance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So essentially what we're doing is two things. Number one is we provide the technology to the banks that actually allows them to deliver that API, because obviously that it involves a connection to a core banking system. And then on the other side, we act as what's known in the industry as a TPP or third-party processor. And that means in your case, for example, we're your third-party processor. We will go and get that data from your bank account or accounts, and we will deliver it to where you have authorized us to do. Okay, so for example, let's say you
Let's start with the easier one, my relationship with the bank. So I own a bank account, and my bank might want to say, hey, Yannis, you have a couple of bucks lying around on the side. They're not doing anything for you. Wouldn't you like to put them into a savings account or invest them into the markets or stuff like that? Those recommendations are possible if my bank has implemented your software. So your customer is the bank?
No. Our customer for one of our products is the bank, but our customer for many of the other products will be somebody else. It could be a lender, could be a business that you want to have a credit line with, for example, and they want to run a credit check on you. Could be your landlord that says, hey, before we allow you to rent this property, we want to do a check on you. And rather than you having to send them, you know, your employment contract, proof of address, 3-month bank statements, instead they say, give us your bank account number and authorize us to go and get the data. They will look in your bank account and go, yep, we can see regular income. We can see that that's been coming in for a certain period of time. So, yep, absolutely, we're going to allow this person a credit line, and we're going to allow them to move into this property.
Got it. And does it matter to you if that account holder is an individual or a business?
Not really, no. There's slightly different rules, but that's getting very technical. The reality is
you can do both. You can.
Absolutely, you can do both. Absolutely, you can do both.
All right. I think I'm getting this part better now. And what's the second part of the business? How does that work where you're the third party provider?
Well, so where we're the third party provider, that's where we are getting the data on your behalf. The first bit is the bank has got to have technology in place to deliver the API so that you can go and get the data. Essentially, do you remember, I'm probably going back too far, but do you remember when you couldn't really send business cards around easily because there were so many different formats, and then people came out with V-card? Essentially.
True. Yes, I remember that in the beginnings of Microsoft Outlook. That's a few years ago.
I'm showing my age here. I've been doing this for a while. But essentially, what the two bits are, firstly, in order to essentially create an open market in which financial data can be moved around efficiently and effectively, you need something standardized, right? So in other words, let's say you've got not one bank account, but let's say instead you've got 3 or 4 with different banks. It's not going to be terribly useful if that data comes in 3 or 4 different forms. So essentially what the directive did was not just say that the data had to be available, but it created a standardized form in which it had to be available so that it could be used much more effectively. Because once you have a standard for delivering data, you then allow lots of people. And that was why I answered the question the way I did, instead of saying, no, it's not just these people. It's theoretically almost anyone because it's a standardized form. Okay. So it could be a credit lender. It could be somebody just wanting to verify your identity so you can, you know, check into the luxury suite in the Adlon Kempinski in Berlin, for example.
All right, got it. So we spent about 6 minutes now of me trying to understand your business model in a bit more detail. When that's the case on the show, then it's normally not a business model that you come up with when you are in line for an ice cream or something like that, or a walk in the park. But it sounds like you've had to deal with banks and financial data before. How did you end up with this business idea?
Well, in fairness, it wasn't my idea. So I have been a founder in the past, but this is actually a position here at Quest that I took on coming up to 2 years ago. And to be quite candid, it's very interesting. I think, to your point, you know, where did this come from? In this case, most of this came from actually driven by regulation, which was a strength and a weakness. Okay, so the strength was it kind of pushed technology forward. And so businesses came up to allow, you know, usage of and delivery of this new regulation. But I was initially a cynic. Right? I moved to Berlin, did a turnaround and sale of another business, and was then actually planning on taking some time off. Got talking to investors, and they said, and I had previously had exposure to obviously the fintech and finance markets, and they said, you know, we're interested in this space. And the reason they were particularly interested in the space was because there'd been a lot of focus on technology, a lot of focus on, okay, how do we do this? How do we connect A to B and all of this kind of stuff? And to my mind, way insufficient focus on, okay, what benefit does this give somebody? In other words, if I'm talking to you and saying, hey, you know, we can support this protocol and that protocol, and we can connect to 4,400 banks across Europe and all of this, that doesn't really allow you to go, okay, why would I do this? Why is it useful to me as a consumer?
What can I do with it?
Exactly. And so for me, the bit was realizing that the market was now changing. Instead, people were looking at it much more from the perspective of, okay, now we've got all the technology, you know, the wiring and the connectivity, all of that done. What are we going to do with it? I mean, it's exactly like the mobile internet, right? Nobody talks about mobile internet anymore, because it's not, we don't think about that. We think about, it's my banking app, it's my navigation app, I'm doing things, it relies on a technology. So what I've described in one sense is kind of the same, but for financial data. So the question then becomes, what are you going to do that's useful?
Many founders know this. Time is the most valuable resource in the SaaS business, but time tracking often falls short. Excel sheets, manual additions, a lack of overview of projects or invoices, and that's exactly where Clockadoo comes in. Clockadoo is a simple, smart time tracking tool specifically designed for small and medium-sized businesses. You can transparently track working hours, projects, and budgets, and instantly see how much time each client, team, or topic is taking up. The whole thing works online, on mobile, or on the desktop app, and it integrates into your existing tool landscape. Clockadoo is a real relief, especially for SaaS founders who want to keep track of everything and issue accurate invoices. Try it out for yourself at clockadoo.com.
And the answer to that is, there's an awful lot you can do that is useful. You know, essentially, once you have got, say, 2 to 5 years of financial data, and critically, you can interpret it. And that interpretation is actually at least as difficult as getting it, if not more so. Okay. Because frequently, I don't know about you, but I look at my bank statement. And when I do, I go, hang on a second, I don't recognize that transaction.
Because what is that?
It's the legal name of the entity with which I transacted, not their trading name. And there's maybe 6 characters of text, and I'm going, I don't know what that is.
So what I'm really interested as a consumer is, this month you've spent 600 euros on restaurants and 500 euros on new shoes. What is wrong with you? And do you really need that many shoes? And that's the kind of question I want my ass to be asking. Do you also offer services like that? Because I know there are private, like household expenditure managers for individuals, or is that something that you're not touching?
No, we will provide the categorized data to people doing that. And typically, at the risk of sounding smug, we'll do it better than anybody else, certainly in the dark market. And the reason I make that claim is, different markets give you little clues. I mean, we've got over 300,000 rules to classify financial data, plus machine learning tech, plus databases of the co-partners that you'll actually be transacting with. So we know that, okay, yes, you transacted with company X, but actually, as far as you're concerned, they're trading under the name Z. Right. And you know, we can pick up some really interesting stuff in there. I think the first time I myself was shocked the first time somebody said, okay, oh, you've got two children. And I went, how'd you know that? It's there in the bank account data, if you look at it in the right way. And if you know, both in, you know, most European territories, you get child allowance, mm-hmm. or Kindergeld, as it's known in Germany. If you know what the amounts are related to how many children you have, you can turn that somewhat esoteric number into useful information. And then you can say to somebody, for example, well, look, actually, you know, you've just got a third child. And we're looking here that your life insurance, you're only paying this much, which implies, based on current rates, that you're probably only insured for this kind of amount. And that's not enough, you know, because we can also look at that account and go, your current, you know, standard spending, not discretionary. So the stuff that you have to pay, you know, the payment on your car, the mortgage on your house, food, you know, insurances, et cetera, you wouldn't be able to cover that for more than about 10 months were something to happen to you with this kind of cover. So, you know, you've got three kids.
So
you
I need totally to understand why that data is valuable. How does it work that I give consent for other parties to look at that data or for you to process that data? And who are your customers and how do they approach me? That's the part of the equation that I'm still missing.
No, okay. And that's exactly the point. And that's why it is slightly hard to explain, because there can be so many of them. So the person who's approaching you isn't usually not approaching you, if you see what I mean. What you're trying to do is you're trying to do something, and they're suggesting that there is an easier, faster, better way of doing it by, instead of giving them lots of other information that would take you time and effort and be hard to source, mm-hmm. instead what they say to you is, okay, Yanis, give us your bank account data and give us a one-time permission or a three-month permission, your control, to access and do something useful with the data. So essentially, you are the one that is instigating the process, and it's completely under your control. And that's really, really important, because you own the data. So bottom line is, why would you give anybody access to your bank account data? Well, the answer is because there's some benefit to you in doing that. And so that's the critical point. So the people who are going to be asking you to say, will you do this, are exactly the ones that I was just talking about. So it could be your landlord or a landlord, you know, management platform saying, well, you want to move into this property. Do you want to spend a few hours collecting all the necessary data and sending it over to us, and then it will take us a while to process it all? Or do you want to literally just put in your IBAN number and we'll come back to you with an approval or not, or maybe sort of requirement for a guarantor within, you know, seconds or minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So okay. There's a benefit to you. And that's the fundamental point, that there has to be some benefit. Otherwise, why would you do it? I mean, another classic use case, very simple, but incredibly powerful. So you've decided you want a new bank account. Right? Somebody's made you a good offer. You said, okay, I open the bank account. But now you've got to transfer all of your standing orders and direct debits and payments, your salary check, to that new bank account. Right? If you use this technology, what we can do is go through and go, okay, here's every recurring contract that you have in your previous bank account. Do you want to switch them over? And that process can be automated. So something that, again, huge disincentive, by the way, for people to switch without this kind of technology. Right? It just makes it easy. So this is, funnily enough, yeah.
So this could be a service offered by a new bank that wants to win me as a new customer and say, look, we'll take care of everything. Give us a one-time permission and we'll switch all your accounts. I totally get it.
And we do it. That's exactly, we deliver that service.
You do it in the background, but you do not approach the customer. So the bank will contact me about it, and you just have to win the bank as a customer in this case.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So
and if, it's not like you're forced.
If I know the name Quint or not, totally does not matter to you as a consumer. You only need financial institutions and service providers to know your name.
Yeah, I mean, and even there, we just need people to understand that there is a value in connecting to financial data, and that, you know, we can do that, and we can, as I said, and we can classify that data to make it useful. So we could say, for example, you know, you want to set up something as basic as an account with your local supermarket because it's easier and quicker for checkout, or you want to do in-store scanning, right? They're probably going to want to do a basic credit check on you. Super easy. Give them your bank account number. They can do that immediately. But you wouldn't know that it was us actually providing the data. Not least because, I mean, we're actually regulated by BaFin, which is the German financial regulator, because obviously this is very sensitive data. But actually, in those circumstances, we're really just passing the data on your behalf to somebody else so that they can do something useful for you.
So I totally see that there is value in people purchasing the permission to access data on that level. How do you market your services, and how do you price them for your customers?
We could spend a lot of time on that. The reason being that we have different products. So there's essentially the way that we sell to the large financial institutions to set up the APIs. And then there's a different model for how we sell to people wanting to access the data. And then there are point solutions such as bank account switching or financial identity verification, which just have a per use cost. However, the answer to all of those is they are all a mix of, they're all ARR based businesses. So it's that our focus is on recurring revenue and recurring use. So people are paying for things as they use them. They're not paying massive capital payments up front. But then there's a variation between, how do we price based on different elements. So the key element will be the size, the volume. How much data do you want to do this? Because clearly that's what drives value. But there are other things that also drive the cost. Obviously, where we're integrating with a bank, there's costs associated with getting it fully set up and integrated. And the more territories that we have to operate in and the more regulators we end up touching, that will also drive costs.
All right. And to get an understanding for the size of company you're running there, at which level, revenue level, if you can share that, did you take over as a CEO? You started about 2 years ago in January of 2024.
Yeah.
And what's your ambition? Where do you want to get Quest?
Okay. So right now we're just under 10 million in ARR and we're looking to double that.
In which time frame?
In a basically a 24 months time frame. Faster would be better. A little bit slower is not the end of the world, but it's an exciting time because, as I think I mentioned, right now this space is getting much more exciting because initially it was very focused on the technology. Now, and this is, this is part of the issue I think, I'm having here explaining, because there's so much you can do with this data. So that's the challenge, but that's also the massive opportunity. There's so much that you can do once you've got fully categorized data. You can tell, for example, straight away that somebody's having a problem with gambling, and you can help them with that. More data is coming soon. So right now it's current accounts, but soon it'll be wealth and insurance and other pretty much all financial data will have to be delivered through these APIs.
And do your customers typically already have a pretty good use case in mind when they first contact you, or do you create use cases and do you create a value story to win new customers? How do these conversations go, and how do you do go to market?
Typically we're the ones explaining to prospects how they can use this data to add value or to reduce cost or to do things better. Now, that's not so much the case with the banks, because the banks know that they have to comply with a piece of legislation. So there, we're typically talking to, you know, heads of governance, and we're saying, hey, why would you do this yourself? Because it's going to be much more expensive. You can buy the technology from us. We'll operate it for you. It costs you less. It's better. It's faster. And it stays up to date with the legislation. So we'll take away that headache from you. But on the other side, it's very much us going and explaining to somebody, well, hang on a second. You know, you want to run this process, right? You're looking to validate people, or let's say you're looking to lend money to people, right? The value that you can get and the speed with which you can operate, if literally, you know, I walk into a bank and say, hey, you know, I'd like to borrow some money to buy a new car, you know, that's quite a lengthy process. However, you know, we can do it, and we do it on the two largest secondhand portals, car sales portals in Germany, mm-hmm. where that whole process can be automated and take place in seconds. Right? Where literally you could say, okay, I need to finance this vehicle. Okay, I'm going to authorize release of my financial data to the potential lender. The lender's then got all that data to make an informed decision. They can come back within, you know, it's in seconds, and say,
Do you also develop the algorithms behind the yes or behind a go or no-go decision? Or do you provide the raw data in a curated format so that the lender can then decide, I want to have my own criteria and I have different cutoff points?
We provide the data, and we will help. We absolutely will help them refine and develop the model based on, you know, obviously we've built up massive abilities to process and understand financial data. So we absolutely will help them with it, but it will be unique. And that's one of the benefits of this, in that if you think about it, there's huge issues associated with using standardized credit scores, because standardized credit scores are massively weighted towards large scale financial circumstances. So houses, cars, you know, large property refurbishments, those kind of things. Okay. What we find is, you know, if you've got much smaller loans, say buy now, pay later type loans, to buy much smaller items, maybe average loan will be 400-500 euros. If people are going to fall into some kind of financial pressure, their commitment to repaying that small loan is not the same as their commitment to repaying their mortgage or their car loan, which are things that they need to keep. So that, you know, that's just one small case, but that absolutely is something where really the lender can, with this kind of data, get much, much more focused and much more accurate, and make sure that they're not lending to the wrong people that are going to have a problem, and also properly rewarding people, you know, that have a great history. I mean, you know, we can look at a bank account, obviously, and we will give something like what's called an income stability metric, mm-hmm. which is basically saying, are you getting roughly the same amount of money? Now, you think about it, if you delivered a 3 months of bank statements, how representative is that of
exactly three
financial
months
history? It's 3 months, exactly. Yeah. Whereas if you've got 2 to 5 years, that measure of stability is worth so much more. So to answer your question directly, because I'm cognizant we wandered slightly off track, the answer is, typically what we are doing is, some people are starting to realize that they need this themselves. Other people, we are reaching out to them and saying, you could make this so much more efficient. I mean, even banks themselves, banks are said, you know, people say the bank, but the reality is, if you're talking about a large bank, it's you're really effectively talking to many, many different subgroups within that, right? And with current GDPR legislation across Europe, some banks have put themselves in the position where they can't actually easily share customer account data with other parts of the bank that would really like to have it. So because they've put it in one place, now it's, well, we need permission. Now, we can obviously manage that because part of the whole process is managing permission, because that's critical, right? People need to trust that their data is still fully under their control, and that they, you know, the fact that you just gave permission to somebody to pull your data once doesn't mean that they can do anything else with it. It means that they need to only retain it for as long as they need it for the purposes of making the decision, and then it's got to be deleted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when we come back to that, it's making sure, making absolutely sure that this is creating value and solving a problem, and making ideally the consumer or the end user, making their life easier, or protecting them, or from a business perspective, not lending things to people that, you know, they shouldn't. But the future for this, you know, where we go with this is really, really exciting. Because if you think about it, if you've got full information, so not just current accounts, once you add in wealth accounts, insurance, investments, pensions, life insurance, then the ability that you have to say to somebody, well, actually, with the current market conditions, financial market conditions, with interest rates and loan rates and all the rest of it, you can then start giving them some really intelligent advice to make big difference to their financial health.
Absolutely.
And that's where it gets very exciting, because you can say, no, don't put money aside, right? You've got loans, actually. Currently, because the interest rates are so low, you would be much better off paying those loans off faster than trying to put money into a savings account. You feel good because you kind of, you've got a nice number sitting in that savings account, but actually that's hurting you financially because you're paying way more in interest on the loan. But then things can switch. You know, when interest rates go high, you can go, no, absolutely, leave that loan running on the car, keep your money in your savings account, because that's making more than your is going out.
But, I can totally see why that adds value to an individual, and thank you for taking the time to also drilling down on the details, really. Now, with you being an expert on the matter, I'd also like to zoom out a little bit. You've mentioned trends like buy now, pay later, and microcredits and the like. Do you think there is a shift? Are we getting in dangerous waters that people cannot fulfill their credits anymore? Or is there a shift? Is there a tendency towards that?
Well, I think the big risk in that space, and this is and here I'm actually speaking for myself rather than Quiz specifically, because it's as we just alluded to, this isn't a decision that we make. My perspective on it is the way that buy now, pay later works for most consumers is that the lending criteria are actually pretty loose, because what they're doing is understanding that in a very broad cohort of people, there will be X percent of churn or X percent of default. Now, that's why the numbers tend to be small. That's why buy now, pay later lenders typically will not lend large amounts, because they don't do super thorough credit checks because it's too hard, or they don't have the data. And so what you've got is somebody saying, look, if I take 1 million people, I know that across those 1 million people, there will be X amount of default on this type of loan. Therefore, I'll take those 1 million people and I'll just make sure that I'm making enough to cover the default level. But that's ignoring the fact that, you know, people defaulting on, you know, buy now, pay later is not, you know, that's not fun for anybody. That's not fun for the individuals concerned. And it would be better if they weren't doing that at all. So the opportunity is, because this is automated, because it's fast, the necessary models can now be built, which means we can be much more accurate. And I think that is actually quite important, because otherwise what you're doing is you're kind of accepting that you will have lent money to a whole bunch of people that you shouldn't have lent money to, and that will cause them problems. I mean, it causes you as a lender a problem, but it also causes the recipient a problem. So for me, I think that space does need to get a bit more responsible rather than just saying, hey, there's a big cohort, we can make money out of it, and we'll just accept that there's a level of default that can be quite high.
And now I'm thinking, you're sitting on tremendously valuable data there that would also be of great interest to financial analysts and economists. Do you also have a business model where you derive macroeconomic trends from your data that you can then pass on to other institutions like think tanks, economic forums, or governments?
We were just working on that, funnily enough. The reason that, yes, we do, but we are BaFin regulated and GDPR compliant. And the issue with that is you've got to fully depersonalize that data. And what I mean by fully depersonalize is let's imagine, right? I say, okay, you can use my data as long as it's fully anonymized. But suppose my data contains information that you and I did business, or I sent you some money, or you sent me some money. So then your name would be in my bank account data. So we have to make sure that it gets thoroughly scrubbed so that nobody's personal information is ever released. But yeah, the potential here is huge. You know, we could potentially tell, you know, the mayoralty in Berlin, average income in Neukölln is X, average rental payment is Y, average disposable income is this. Yes, there's huge opportunity. It's not one that we have yet tackled.
I'm an economist by training. That'd be really fun data to look into. So
no, exactly. It's an area that we're working on right now. But we just have to figure out, making sure the guardrails are there to protect individuals and that nobody's information is ever inadvertently exposed. Because that would be unacceptable.
Got it. Okay. Now I'd like to take a step back in your career, because before joining Quist, you were with Search Metrics, if I got that right. And I was wondering what hacks, what learnings from SEO, how well a service, a website is findable on the web, have you taken to Quist, and which of the principles you've learned there have you applied to your new role?
That's a good question. The key learning is actually a very simple one, which is that, and it's the good thing is it also applies in the AI era, which is that content is king, right? I think a lot of SEO was very much in the early days essentially trying to trick the algorithms to generate a higher ranking than the content necessarily merited. Over time, of course, the search engines got wise to that and had a lot of smart tech to try and stop that. But also that was short term. So people used to do all kinds of tricks like what we call de-intentionalizing. So you would search for, say, BMW M5 car insurance. And then somebody would say, well, hang on, I can make more money out of selling that click or that search if it's just car insurance. Because more people, but then they'd take you through to a site, and you've probably seen this in the past. They would take you through to a site that wouldn't insure a BMW M5 because it's a performance car. So there were all these kind of things going on. And what we really discovered over the nearly 4 years I was with Search Metrics, our focus became more and more, and now Conductors, which was the business that bought Search Metrics, the focus is so much on content, and that process really paid off. Now we move into the era of AI search. So basically it's making sure that what you're doing is some things are as old as human civilization. What do people actually want? What are they looking for? What are they trying to do? And how do you explain that to them clearly? And so, our learnings and what I very much applied straight away to Quist was we did look like a very much technology driven company. And I said, hang on a second, people don't want to buy technology, they want to buy solutions. So we focused very much on, for each of our product lines, who were we selling to, what problems did they need to solve that we could help them with, And how could we then also align our business model so that, you know, the typically large companies, they have purchasing committees and all the rest of it, so that we could clearly show them that there was a return on their investment.
I'll try to make this super, break this down to really small pieces for other entrepreneurs who are listening, because I know there's founders out there asking themselves exactly that. How do I put my offering on the web so that the relevant people actually find me? Would you then recommend to have one dedicated landing page per use case, per buyer persona, or how do you do that at Quest?
As far as we can, yes. I think the more you can talk to somebody directly, and bear in mind that, you know, this is the beauty of content-led search, and that the search engine is getting much better and the AI search engine is getting really good at finding content. You know, what questions are people asking, right? What are they looking for, right? In other words, how much of this can you make it pull rather than push, right? Because if I'm coming to you and I don't fully understand your needs, I'm going to be trying to find what you might need that I might want to sell you, okay, or that I can sell you, right? So much better if actually what I can do is put some content out that says, hey, you're an IT person within a bank, you're spending an absolute fortune, and by the way, the regulation has just changed, so you're going to have to re-engineer your PSD API. Guess what? We can do it for a third of the price, right? And it'll be available much faster. And by the way, we offer a guarantee that we'll keep it compliant with future legislation, so we won't come back to you and say, here's another one-off bill. As long as you keep paying the annual bill, we'll keep making sure that the tech is up to date.
So the way you put it now, Matt, sounds like it makes total sense for the person requiring information, sitting in front of the screen, consuming that information, and it totally makes sense structuring that in a meaningful way that search engines can find that information. I have to change anything in that strategy now that we have chatbots and agents and the agentic web is around the corner, or is that strategy still sufficient?
I think at a high level, the high level strategy is completely sufficient, but the execution of that strategy is now more complex.
Okay? And how can you crack it?
Well, if you think about it, in the past, it was fairly easy, right? We could just see for a keyword, and a keyword was never a keyword, essentially it was a phrase, right? You could just go and do the research and say, well, how many people are searching for this? How many people are searching for that? How do we address that? This now becomes much harder where you've got, as you say, agentic AI and all the other tools that people can now use to find stuff. So the bottom line is it's much, much harder to go, okay, how do I know what people are looking for? And that requires, to be honest, you sort of going back to early days of digital advertising, where, you know, we used to say to people, do not expect your marketing to deliver instant results. What you've got to do is you've got to be courageous. You've got to try a bunch of stuff and learn and talk to people. There is a strong element here of, you know, there's tech that can help you. But at a bottom level, as a founder stroke CEO, you've got to think, okay, I had a great idea to solve a problem, right? I can solve this problem. Okay, now I need to understand, how do people talk about the problem? And that's the key, right? Understanding how people talk about that problem, right? I've had several instances in the past where the language just doesn't match, right? Okay? So somebody talks about credit risk and somebody else talks about default risk.
And do you learn that in personal conversations, or is there a more scalable way to understand which language your customers are using?
Technology can help you with that.
What's the best way to help?
Going back to it, I would say use a modern, I think they still call it SEO, but yeah, use a modern SEO tool. They are going and sampling and pulling data from these other sources to find out how people are talking about things. But you've also got to understand that people talk about things in different ways. So let's, real case, Peloton, right? Well, I mean, they're not doing so well these days, but for a while they were doing brilliantly. How did they do brilliantly? They did brilliantly because they were talking the language particularly of use case. So, for example, mums coming back to fitness, and they talked about classes. They didn't talk about running machines. They didn't talk about the hardware, right? If you search for treadmills, you didn't, frequently they were not at the top. But if you talked about exercise for post-pregnancy or post-birth, that's where they appeared. So that's exactly the thing. It's understanding the solution that you're providing, not the thing in and of itself. And also, I mean, this is where you could do come into business models, getting your business model right and selling in a way that makes it easy. And again, sometimes people don't, especially I think founders, they don't think about the implications of that. They don't think about purchasing committees and contract departments and legal departments and the way that they can find a way to make their proposition work well with their typical customer.
So am I summarizing this correctly if I say understand the language your customer is speaking, try to understand which problem your actual buyer persona customer is trying to solve, and then outline the solution and how you deliver value for that customer and put that on your website.
Yeah, and but then you also make it easy for them to buy, right? This is where you go a step further, right? If you're selling to, let's say, middle managers within large organizations and they have typically budgets approval levels of 30 to 40K, then you probably want to say, okay, yeah, in an ideal world, we'd like to have 2-3 year contracts. But that means that the internal department is going to say that's 120K project if it's 4 years at 3 years at 40K. Maybe I shouldn't try and do that. Maybe if I've got confidence in my product, I should say to the customer, you know what? It's a 1 year contract, which you can choose to renew. And we, and so you can, and this is pretty
terminates automatically by default.
Well, you can do terminate. You can say it terminates automatically by default, but you have the right to extend it. So, right. And that would be putting yourself at a degree of perhaps discomfort because you say, well, hang on a minute. So this it's no longer equal. They've got a right that we haven't got. So we've got no right to extend, but they've got the right to extend if they want to on the same terms. But if that's, especially if you're at the scale up stage, you want to think about those little details as to what is your typical customer's ability to buy? How does their process work?
And then you
have
this conversation in the boardroom when the investor asks if that's really annual recurring revenue, if you have a termination clause in there. But we'll keep that for a different episode.
Absolutely right.
Matt, there's one more thing that I'd like to talk about on a bit more personal note. Now, you've led various companies in high growth phases and in complex spaces. So as a CEO, leading those fast scaling companies, what's one leadership or strategy lesson that you've learned over the years that applies again and again and again?
Make sure that you have taken the kinks out of the process, right? Process matters. So we've talked about the value, but essentially you've got to build clarity within your organization so that everybody understands and matches to that process. So you build, if you want to scale, what you need to do is build a toolkit or the backpack. You can call it what you like, but it's about that transition from, if you like, generating market fit, right? So now we've found market fit, now we want to scale. The process of scaling requires you to break it down again and go, okay, we cannot, right? We cannot go and take a year to sell to one customer anymore if we're going to scale, right? So now both the technology offering has got to be a scalable one, and that's a whole other conversation, how you make that scalable. but your commercial operation has also got to be scalable. And so you need to build your backpack. So obviously you need standardized pricing, standardized contracts, a commercial approach that matches, as we just said, and makes it easy for people to buy. Okay. Depends what scale, stage you're at here. I mean, I used to run actual seminars on pricing strategies, and people were going, oh, well, pricing's pricing, isn't it? And I would say, well, what are you trying to do? This will sell more. I said, oh, but is it sell more at any cost, i.e. that you're prepared to take some risk and you just want to generate momentum, or do you want to maximize profit? Do you want to maximize, you know, long-term ARR, et cetera? And when you push people, they go, okay, now I have to think about that a bit more, because you can use very different strategies depending where you are. So there's that.
And that's still very much true, Matt. I'm just coming out of Artist Summit, and we've had more sessions on pricing and strategic software pricing than ever before. So yeah. Right to your point. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. Go on.
No, but it is so critical. And actually, it's sort of allied to that, is you've got to manage the sales pipeline. Again, what I see, and I for a while I ran an incubator, so I saw a lot of this, where businesses have got some great tech, great ideas, but they weren't going anywhere. And they'd gone, okay, got product market fit. Right now, I'm just going to hire some salespeople. And they didn't think about, okay, I need a marketing department and I need an SDR department. Now, these days with tech, those departments can be smaller than they used to be and much more efficient, right? AI is really good at that early, what we call the early funnel. But you still need a funnel. If you go and hire, you know, as a company that I ran had done, if you go and hire 6 salespeople, but you have got no meaningful marketing or SDR function, then you're setting yourself up for failure, because those people will go, who am I talking to? How do I get? And this stuff takes time, right? We've just talked about it and how hard it is to find the right people that have got the problem that you can then talk to and solve, right? If you're using expensive salespeople to try and find those people, forget it. It's not going to work. So it's so, so critical that you understand the ROI of what you're offering. So what does it solve? By the way, one of the things that I always do, I wouldn't say it's essential, but for me, I find it hugely helpful with larger companies, is I've always got an ROI model that I'm happy to share with a customer and work through with them and then hand it over to them and say, there you go. And it's something that they can then take to an approval committee or a purchasing department and go, there's my business case.
I love it.
And I've validated the numbers in there.
You're building value case for your customer. And you're saying, take the kinks out of the process, you said, right?
Yeah. Take the kinks out of the process. Make it as smooth as you can. The easier it is for somebody to buy, the more you're going to sell. And it's, what was it, Brailsford? Dave Brailsford was the head of UK cycling for a while. And he coined the phrase marginal gains. And I don't use that phrase, but I call it taking the grit out of the process, right? Figure out, where do you get stuck? Now, some things you cannot change, right? But a lot of things you can, right? You can change your, if there's terms in your contract that are always being argued, have a very long think and go, do we actually need them, right? Are we sort of gilding the lily in terms of protecting ourselves and not taking a measured risk?
And it's, I think, very, that's actually easy. Two great takeaways to provide as homework for the founders who are listening. Really, what are the kinks in your process? How can you take them out? And are there any clauses that are constantly being challenged by customers, and do you really need them? So thanks for those pieces of advice, Matt. And we wouldn't be on the Artist on Air show if I didn't have our final question to you. Matt, you live in Berlin. You have been living in Berlin since a while now, so I'm sure you have a favorite restaurant that you'd like to recommend to our listeners, where they should go for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Doesn't matter. What's your favorite restaurant?
My current favorite restaurant, and I didn't have to think more than about a second on this, is called Golvet, G-O-L-V-E-T. It is a Michelin starred restaurant, but it's a very creative and young team in a venue that used to be a nightclub with a fantastic view of the city. And I couldn't recommend it highly enough. But the thing that really makes it is the people there. It's just people that are passionate about food and what they can do with it, and that they all want to make it better and to make
Golvet
it exciting.
Golvet in Berlin. I just checked the website while you talked, and I think the club was called 40 Seconds that was in there, that used to be in there, right?
Exactly.
Used to go to 40 Seconds, but I haven't made it to Golvet yet. But I'll change that when the opportunity comes up. So thank you so much for taking the time. Thanks so much for the restaurant recommendation, Matt. It was a real pleasure talking to you. And then I hope to talk to you soon. Enjoy the rest of your vacation, and thank you so much for taking some time off for us.
No, thank you. I really appreciate it, and really fantastic to chat with you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
I certainly hope you enjoyed this episode. And even if I may repeat myself, go to the website now. Get your super early bird ticket for Artist Summit 2026 right about now at artist.net.